Hey guys, welcome to the Weekly Papist. It's your host, Michael and Gio. And today, you know, we're going to be talking about a spiritual writing from the Doctor of the Church, St. Alphonsus Liguori. But before we begin, Gio.
Very pressing question, I imagine.
Oh, very pressing. If you could have the ability to pick up any skill instantly, like at this moment, like you would just like, I want to be like a plumber, or for instance, okay. What skill would you choose and why?
I think it would be the ability to learn another language, like okay. almost instantly. Because I think there's kind of two, like at least from like a UD perspective, right? There's like languages that are practical, for example, like, you know, Italian for when we go to Rome, or like, you know, even California, knowing Spanish, but also like, for example, knowing Greek or Latin. Like, I think that, like, for just aside from the fact, like, oh yeah, be able to, you know, say you know the language and to be able to read, like, for example, certain works in their original language, like, it's just awesome. Be like, yeah, I can read original Latin.
Yeah. You know? Okay. So, is it the ability to learn any language instantly, or the ability to learn a specific one?
I think probably to learn any language.
Okay. Instantly. Okay. That's actually a really good one. I think, honestly, I would do the same. Like, I only know English. Like, I took 9 years of Spanish at, like, my, like, kindergarten through eighth grade school. I know, like, Rojo. That's, like, the extent
yeah,
of my
it's
Spanish
like, there's
knowledge.
All, it's, like, the numbers, the colors, and, like, maybe some animals.
Maybe some animals. I'm going to go that. Oh, gatto, of course, the cat. Okay. And then in French, I took, or in high school, I took French, which was just the worst experience of my life.
I feel like everyone I've talked to who took high school in French, who took French in high school, if they weren't already fluent, I felt like they had a miserable time. I don't know what it was.
Absolutely miserable. And I think it was because, like, they only pronounce, like, the first half of the word. And so, like, you have the second half they don't pronounce. And, like, it just makes like listening comprehension very difficult if you're not very good. Because, like, you really need to pick up on, like, the context clues. Like, what's happening and why? So, like, why are they using this word in particular? Because, like, fey and fey, those are like this. That's like that verb is conjugated differently. That's spelled differently, but it's pronounced the same. And so, like, it was just horrible. And my teachers were okay. I just didn't really put the time or effort in. So it really was like my bad, but like it was just atrocious.
Yeah.
And then so I'm taking Latin now, which I enjoy a lot better.
Well, that's good. Yeah. I mean, I had the same thing with you, right? Like, you know, the 9 years of Spanish in middle school, didn't learn anything. And then I took Mandarin in high school, which, as interesting as it was, you know, didn't work out in the long run. It's a very difficult language, especially since you're dealing with, like, non-English letters as well.
But you do know some sentences still, don't you?
To some extent. It's the other issue as well is because they don't – I didn't get to – like, I stopped after year three because I had, like, the credit requirements. But it's year four when they teach you about tones, because in Mandarin, there's four different tones and how you're supposed to pronounce it. So, like, one word, depending on how you pronounce it, has, like, four different meanings.
Do you have any examples?
So, for example, ma was one word. Like, the way we would normally say it in a sentence, it means mother. I could be wrong about this, but if I remember hearing my teacher correctly, he's like, you have to be really careful how you say that word, because if you say it in a certain way, it's like a curse word. So, like, you have to be very spot on with your pronunciations. And when you write it, you can kind of indicate what tone it is, but especially when speaking it, where there's, like, you know, miscommunication.
Wait, you can write it and you can indicate what tone when you write it out? It's built into the character?
Yeah, because there's... And they use when teaching us. There's different. It's sort of like accent marks,
okay.
In a way, but it's a whole different concept, because what they would have is there's like the characters, right? Like, you know, like Chinese characters, but then they have what's called pinyin, which is you write out the word as it's pronounced, like as you would say, but it's in English letters.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like ni hao, for example. The pinyin would be like ni space hao. H-A-O, and then, like, the character, and then you'd have, like, the character.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're typing on a keyboard, you type in, like, the English pronunciation, and it turns it into the character.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, I still occasionally, if I'm, like, typing on my, like, iPad keyboard, I'll press, like, the button by accident that switches it over to Chinese, and then I'll just accidentally start, like, typing, like, Chinese characters onto, like, my paper. I'm like, oh, that is not what I'm supposed to be doing.
It's actually really interesting. I heard Mandarin's the hardest language to learn. Is that true?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, honestly, if I would think English is probably one of the hardest to learn.
I don't think it's actually, like, that bad compared to, like, languages like Hungarian or, like, Mandarin. Well, for an English speaker.
Okay.
Maybe, like, in terms of just, like, if you're just, like, a blank slate trying to, right, like, learn it, it'd probably be extraordinarily difficult.
That's fair.
But I heard Mandarin's, like, considered one of the hardest. And it takes, like, about, like, 12 years to, like, master it.
I mean, considering my time with it, yeah, I probably wouldn't be surprised.
Hey, you took 3 years, though, so that's pretty good.
Yeah, you know. I'll take what I can get. But speaking of learning foreign languages and other random skills, we have, as Michael said, the spiritual reading. And this is actually directly from the Office of Readings.
Yes.
Before we start, though, just a little, I guess, brief business announcement. Earlier this past week, and this is more so for those who are at the University of Dallas, we did put up some official flyers for the podcast with a QR code you can scan, if I guess your phone can do that. And we have, you know, the thing for the Instagram account. We also have Twitter. So if you are new, welcome. We're happy to have you. But we have a few of those flyers up around campus. They're light blue, and they have the logo and the QR code. I think one is in, yeah, there's one in Hagar, one in the science building, and then two in Gorman. So you'll probably see them at some point, assuming they don't get, like, taken down or anything. But
no, definitely.
Have any questions, feel free to message us.
Yeah, so we're just going to get started with St. Alphonsus Liguori's, one of his writings from his Office of Readings. And his feast day is on August 1st. But this is a very good reading, so we figured we'd just give it a little shot. It's a bit short. So we're going to do, like, a paragraph-by-paragraph reading, and we're just going to talk about it. Also really interesting, they're actually going to update the Liturgy of the Hours, I believe, they're in terms of, like, the translation.
I remember you mentioning that. When's the new translation supposed to come out?
I believe it's coming out 2024. Oh. So, of course, like, we know, like, we have the 1970s translations, and those were kind of just, like, pumped out, like, very, very quickly, like, within the, you know, like, a few, I want to say, like, a year, maybe, like, a few years. But, like, the idea was, like, okay, we have all these Latin books. We just need to get them into English as quickly as possible.
So it was a good enough translation, but there's probably some left to be desired.
Yeah, so, for instance, what they would do is, because there's so much to translate, a lot of the times they'd paraphrase the translations in order as to not introduce, like, heresy, potentially. So, like, for instance, if you're given this big block of Latin text and you're, like, you know, trying to translate it, a lot of times they wouldn't translate it word for word in case of, like, having a mistranslation. So they kind of read it, get the understanding down, and then just paraphrase it.
Oh,
which,
okay,
is unfortunate. And I'm not gonna lie, there aren't a whole lot of pros to that approach. There's definitely a lot of drawbacks. But in the early 2000s, Pope Benedict XVI, so in, like, 2006, I believe, he wrote an encyclical called Liturgium Authenticum, which is basically, like, principles of translation that the Latin Church should follow, like, fidelity to, like, the Latin texts and all that. And there are pros and cons to that approach as well. Basically, that's kind of where we get the 2011 Missal translation from. Like, they did a systematic revision of the entire Missal. And that was released in 2011. And if you compare them, like, there's, like, major changes. Like, so much was, like, updated and made so much better. But the Liturgy of the Hours was kind of one of those books that was kind of put on the side, which is really unfortunate because, like, the office and, like, the Mass are meant to be really connected. So, for instance, like, the collects, like, said in Mass, like, in the beginning, like, when the priest says, "Let us pray," and then he'll say the prayer, and then, like, we respond with Amen.
Yeah.
That collect is meant to be the same in the office as it is in the Mass. But because the Liturgy of the Hours is still operating under the 1970s translation, the collects are very different. Like, the general idea is there, but the collects, when you read them and compare them, are very, very different.
So they're disconnected.
Disconnected. Yeah, so the office is very disconnected from the Mass because we're still using the 1970s translation. At least it feels like that. Additionally, a lot of the hymns in the Latin weren't translated. So, like, back in the 1970s, there's like, okay, we need to get the essentials out, and then we're going to find English hymns that aren't heretical that we'll just insert. So they actually have for... I remember I was praying once, and
a martyr. Didn't they pull hymns from...
Martin Luther?
Yeah.
So like,
I heard about that
yeah,
one.
Yeah, so like in the Common of for Martyrs, they actually have A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. So I was like, okay, like we have like the Latin Church has its like really extraordinarily rich history of like hymns, and like why are we pulling from like this guy? And like, but like some of the hymns aren't great, like they're pretty rough, and like a lot of them were made like in the 70s.
Yeah, because it's like, I mean, sure, maybe there's nothing blatantly heretical in that.
Yeah, but like,
you still have this massive history. Yeah, like you have this massive history of stuff you could pull from, and it's like, oh no, well, just for convenience sake.
Yeah, so they're actually very close to finishing that, and it's really interesting. I was reading an interview by one of the bishops in charge of this project, and he said how like one of the things they're trying to do is trying to make the book beautiful. So for instance, the 2011 Missal, for instance, if you actually look at it, it's like covered in beautiful art, like very famous paintings and frescoes throughout like the history of like, you know, Christianity. They're gonna do the same thing with this.
Nice.
Liturgy of the Hours, because like the art in here is like really not that bad. It's definitely like, I actually don't have a problem with it. It's definitely more of like very simplistic. If you looked at it, like most people probably wouldn't like it.
Yeah.
But I kind of enjoy it because I do feel like we're just so inundated with culture. Like everything like on our phone, like we'll go and like find like celebrities or like, oh, we'll have this like beautiful movie to watch or whatever. And like it can definitely just like overwhelm us, I think.
So yeah, like kind of like some like beauty and simplicity.
Yeah, it's like reading. It's definitely very like Carthusian, I think, in approach. Okay. Like kind of, like known for like having like very bare churches. I really kind of do enjoy like the more simplicity, but it's good. I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that'll be the time when I finally get myself and make the long-term investment.
Yeah, you should. I'm looking. Yeah, it's probably gonna be pretty expensive, but I'm down. I'm down to get it.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, you know, it's fine. We'll make it work.
All right, so I don't want to go ahead and get started.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. From a sermon by St. Alphonsus Liguori. All holiness and perfection of soul lies in our love for Jesus Christ, our God, who is our Redeemer and our supreme good. It is part of the love of God to acquire and to nurture all the virtues which make a man perfect. Okay.
I think it's, I had mentioned this to you previously, I like the, because we, for our moral theology class, we were reading Veritatis Splendor by John Paul II, and in that he mentions that, you know, acknowledging God is at the heart of the law, and it's from there that all of the other virtues, and, you know, so the fruits and gifts of the Holy Spirit proceed. And so I kind of see something similar, like a similar vein in this, that, like, it is part of the, like it says here, it is part of the love of God to acquire, to nurture all the virtues which make a man perfect.
Yeah.
So it's like, without the love of God, nothing else is, none of these virtues are possible.
Exactly.
Through, you know.
And that's kind of like, well, it also kind of brings up, it kind of really reminds me of the, so we're reading, so Veritatis Splendor of JP2, and he analyzes the question the young man asks the Lord, like, Lord, what good must I do to attain eternal life? And one thing I thought that was really interesting was, Jesus like responds very favorably to this idea that this young man could do something which could attain eternal life. Now, obviously, like, you know, like we aren't saved through our own works, but our actions definitely have an influence on what happens and if we attain salvation. And so it's, you know, we have that kind of like that synergism between God's grace and us responding to God's grace in our lives, and like the virtues are one aspect of that, like,
yeah,
like cultivating those like firm or like, you know, habitual dispositions to do the good, which is what's virtues. That's kind of what a virtue is, like a firm or habitual disposition to do the good.
Right.
And
it's through performing those actions that eventually, like at first, you might see them as a chore or it's something. Well, it's something God is making me do, so I like, or says you have to do this, so
yeah,
I'm gonna go do it. But then eventually, like, once it becomes habitual, you eventually come to enjoy it.
Yeah, you enjoy choosing virtue. I like this one part. It is part of the love of God. So it's not the full, like, extent. Like,
there's so much more.
There's so much more, like, beyond obtaining virtue. I think it's very interesting, actually. Like, just, like, receiving the sacraments and, you know, things like that. But, like, wouldn't we kind of classify that underneath virtue? Like, the virtue of religion?
Yeah, I'd say to some extent. I mean, because which was the... I forget which... Pope, as you said, like the Eucharist is like the shortest way to heaven, or something along those lines. That yeah, like that in of itself is, like you said, it's an act of virtue, or like the virtue of religion, but it is only part of it.
Yeah, would you say like the other part is like the grace that we receive, the grace we receive to love God?
I'd say so. Yeah, I mean, because yeah, it's the part of the love of God to acquire and to nurture all the virtues which make a man perfect. I mean, yeah, like it's. I imagine, yeah, grace probably plays a role into that as well, and I imagine, you know, show yourself on earth as well, like your interactions with your community, and like, you know, like the second tablet, mm-hmm. right, of the commandments, like love a neighbor, sorry.
Yeah, you're good.
Like how that sort of plays into it as well. Like it's very broad. There's a lot that can be put into that category of like, well, what's the other part?
Yeah, well, that kind of gets into very interesting, like not necessarily debate, but just like thought. Like, is virtue is not just merely an external action. Virtue is definitely like an internal action. So one could be virtuous, like, I don't want to say alone, but like kind of.
But there is like it's, and I imagine to some extent,
like hermits, for instance. Yeah, technically they're not alone because they have the community of God.
Right. Well, because that had come up in our class as well. Like, you know, because there's one of the natural inclinations of man is that he is a social or political animal, and that he requires community. And so as well, I think, did I ask this question or I forget who it was, but asked like, well, where would like solitary hermits,
I think you actually asked
hermits
this,
or
yeah.
monks. Kind of fall into that. It's like, well, like you said, that they're technically not alone. They're in community with, community with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, yeah, I think in the same way with virtue too, it's, you can be alone and still be a virtuous person.
Right. All right, let's move on to the next paragraph. Has not God, in fact, won for himself a claim on all of our love? From all eternity, he has loved us. And it is in this vein that he speaks to us. O man, consider carefully that I first loved you. You had not yet appeared in the light of day, nor did the world yet exist, but already I loved you. From all eternity I have loved you. Kind of interesting, like, well, it's kind of like we have an obligation to love God. Like, not like, I think we like kind of shy away from that. It's kind of like, well, it's kind of like the freedom and law distinction, one could say.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like we have a human nature which informs human action, and it is only by like human action which fulfills our nature that like we can be happy. And it's kind of very interesting that like obligation, not like in the sense that like it's like imposed down upon us, like you must love me, but just like that invitation to like, look at all the things I've done for you. Like, how could you not love someone so good?
Right. Well, it's I think of it a similar way as well, because I mean, you know, obviously we can consciously choose to reject God's love in one way or another, but like you said, we still have that natural inclination to see, yeah, this is all that God has done for us. How could you, you know, in your right mind, right reason, not choose to love God back? And as well, the sorry, I lost my train of thought a little bit.
No worries.
But it's just such a, like, it's such a beautiful concept, but it's also one that's very difficult to comprehend. Like, even before we existed, before the world existed, God still loved us.
Yeah.
Like, that's such, like it's incredibly beautiful, but also it's, like, really hard to wrap your mind around.
Because God is outside of time as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, there wouldn't necessarily be, he would be able to survey, like, everything. And, like, you know, like it's a very different perspective from God's end than compared to our end.
Yeah.
Because
like, and not only that, but like he still loves you even if you chose, like even if he knew or like knows that, yeah, you're going to slip up and that you're going to reject his love maybe at times or maybe completely, he still loves you regardless.
Right. Okay, don't move on to the next one, or is that everything? Also, I did want to say, like, we do have an obligation to love God, but that obligation necessarily isn't, like, imposed.
Right, like, we still have free will,
yeah. But we're inclined to love God, I think, through our nature.
It's, like, it's not a, like, we're not, our freedom is not hindered, in a sense, by, like, with this obligation to love God. It's more fulfilled when we do. Like, it's more...
Exactly.
We become
more truly human.
More human and truly free when we love God. It's not like we're... Like you said, it's not imposed on us or being forced to. In any
right. Since God knew that man is enticed by favors, he wished to bind him to his love by means of gifts. I want to catch men with the snares, those chains of love in which they will allow themselves to be entrapped, so that they will love me. And all the gifts which he bestowed on man were given to this end. He gave him a soul, made in his likeness, and endowed with memory, intellect, and will. He gave him a body, equipped with the senses. It was for him that he created heaven and earth, and such an abundance of things. He made all these things out of love for man, so that all creation might serve man, and man in turn might love God out of gratitude for so many gifts.
I wonder, what are the chains, or, like, the snares, do you think?
Well, I think there's, like, the gifts. Like, once again, kind of like, how could you not love me who has given you so much? Like, think about, like, in our own, like, personal relationships, we love people for giving us so much less than what God has given us. And because no one can give us what God has given us.
Right.
And, like, you know, like, our parents, you know, they gave us, like, you know, are like the material that, you know, made our bodies. They provided us, you know, with like money to, like, you know, to be fed and to go to school. But God has provided, and we, you know, we love our parents. We have an obligation to love our parents, right? The fourth commandment. But God has provided so much more. I think this line's very beautiful. It was for him that he created heaven and earth in such an abundance of things. It's kind of very interesting. Like,
yeah,
God didn't make heaven and earth just for, like, out of his own desire to, like, you know, to, like, have this for himself. He made it to share with us in communion.
And so it's an invitation then for, like, the whole Christian life then is an invitation. He's like, I've made this place, and I'm extending an invitation for you to join
to share.
And that's kind of like the Christian life in a way.
And it's kind of like, well, it's the idea that good is diffusive. And so God wants, God, like, has a, God, you know, God is love, God is the ultimate goodness. God wants to share. God has I'm not gonna say deep need, because that implies like he has to do something.
Right, he's limited in a sense.
Yeah, he's not limited at all, but he wants to share with us. And I think that's very interesting. And perhaps like one of the reasons for the gifts, he wants to share these good things with us. And so that's why he gives us so much. He gives us a memory. He gives us an intellect. He gives us a will, so that we could choose and love and to serve God.
Right, so more fully appreciate what he's given us and to use those abilities in whatever calling that we're destined for his own, for like for his greater glory.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of like how the perfection of those virtues can lead to is like this recognition that, yeah, none of this is my own doing. This is, this all glory goes to God.
Right, exactly. And I think I'll just quote, I want to catch men with the snares, those chains of love, in which they allow themselves to be entrapped so that they will love me. Interesting, like, I want to catch those men with those snares, those chains of love, in which they will allow themselves to be entrapped.
So it's like they're not even really being entrapped in a, like, I know it's a bit technical, but it's like,
yeah, like, well, we want to be entrapped, kind of like, we should want to be entrapped by God's love, but it definitely gives like a very, like, you know, kind of like a very purified, like very like strong desire for man. Like, I know like God's love for man has been described as kind of like an eros, in the most pure sense of that word, right? Obviously, like, there are different implications with that word that we use, but like, yeah, in the most pure sense of the word, that strong desire for someone, which God possesses for us, and which we should possess for God. And this is kind of the means that God does this, through gifts. And I think it's kind of linking it back, like in the Carmelite tradition, for instance, right? You have very different levels, you have a lot of different levels of prayer. And when someone first begins like the spiritual journey, for instance, they receive a lot of consolations of the soul. So like, they, for instance, they'd like to go to mass, they like to receive, they like to go to adoration, they like to pray the rosary, they like to do all these little devotionals. But are you doing that because you love God or because you love those good feelings? And so that's kind of the second part.
It's like an imperfect desire.
It's an imperfect desire to love God. Exactly. Like, you obviously, like, you appreciate God for sending you these things, but do you love God or do you just love these feelings? Would you do these actions if out of the love of God, if you weren't receiving these good feelings? And that's kind of the second step, the dark night of the senses, where like those good feelings are, and that's not dark night of the soul. That's a later step that most of us probably won't ever reach. Most of us probably will get to dark night of the senses and probably turn back, unfortunately, without God's grace, of course. But do we keep going if we don't have those good feelings? I think that's probably that's what he's talking about, like that initial like act of gift giving through his grace, but also like everything around us is a gift in like the created world.
Well, and I remember related, like you said, you know, the dark night of the senses. I remember I was talking, you know, with you and some of our friends about adoration because I was going to plan on going. And one of the things that one of my friends told me was there will be times when you go and you'll feel as if there's nothing. Like, it'll feel like a desert. It's like you still have to keep pushing yourself to go back because it's God is there and that's what he wants you to do.
Right. And that's not saying that there's no consolations. Like, a lot of the saints talk about, like, once they, like, get over kind of, like, that hump, then, like, the consolations they receive are far, just so much greater and far beyond that what they initially received. Also, an interesting line, the very last one in this paragraph, he made all these things out of love for man so that all creation might serve man, and man in turn might love God out of gratitude for so many gifts. Kind of like, we don't use creation for its own end. We use it primarily to love God. Like, we should use creation, recognize it, okay, this is a gift from God. How can I love God better? Yeah. Not necessarily creation as like its own entity.
Right. It's not just, oh, here's a bunch of materials for my own use. This is something God gave me and we have to use them responsibly.
And matter is good, which is very interesting. And kind of like, he kind of highlights that idea. All right, let's go to the next paragraph. But he did not wish to give us only beautiful creatures. The truth is that to win for himself our love, he went so far as to bestow upon us the fullness of himself. The Eternal Father went so far as to give us his only Son. When he saw that we were all dead through sin and deprived of his grace, what did he do? Compelled, as the Apostle says, by the superabundance of his love for us, he sent his beloved Son to make reparation for us and to call us back to a sinless life. And kind of like, once again, like, it highlights like that definitely, there's definitely a hierarchy of gifts, right?
Yeah.
We have the created world. We have, you know, the gifts of, you know, consolations and prayer. That's like nothing compared to like the greatest gift he gave us, you know, who is the second person of the Trinity, you know, Jesus.
Right. And it's something that's, I think, said quite often, but it can't be said. Now, like, you know, God didn't have to go down in human form and suffer the way he did. Like, he chose to do that completely. And it is the greatest manifestation of his love, I think. It's like, it's one that I think it's sort of taken more for granted, like just kind of accepted, like as a matter of fact, but it's like, there's such a great significance to that.
Yeah, and I think God really did want to become incarnated. I think, because, you know, goodness is diffusive. God wanted to share
in his creation.
I think it's a very beautiful thought. And I think, like, contemplation of the created world can help lead to understand the greatness that is God. Because once we understand, like, oh, this is so good, then we realize, but God is infinitely greater than everything I observe. I think that gives us more appreciation for the incarnation, what that truly means for us.
Like, how boundless his beauty is.
Exactly. And, you know, to call us back to a sinless life, like, we can't do that on our own, with our own works, through our own, like, will. Like, we need Jesus to help us. Once again, go back to that sinless life.
Absolutely.
That was lost through the fall. Kind of interesting, like, that idea of Christian perfection. I think, like, when it comes to perfection, like, there's definitely, like, two elements. Like, there's, like, the... I think that, like, there's the bad element of perfection and the good element of perfection. In the sense, like, the good element of perfection is the idea, like, we need to be, like, spiritually perfect before the Lord, you know, fulfill these obligations out of love for God and love for neighbor. Then there's like that bad aspect of perfection where like how do I present myself to society in a way that, like, you know, appears I have no problems, like, I do everything correctly, like, nothing is out of line in my life.
Or, like, how can I show that I am superior to those around me in this particular area?
Yeah.
When it should be motivated by, I'm doing this for God's glory because, as you know, as an act of thanks for everything he has bestowed upon me in my life.
Right. It's, like, I think proper Christian perfection stems from that recognition that I am broken and I need, and I need God's grace. I can't do this on my own. Whereas I think, like,
starts from humility.
Like, I think a false Christian perfection now is like, I am perfect, I am good, I don't need to improve. I think that those are two very different ideas.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you hear people today say, like, well, I'm a perfectionist, you know, I have to do X, Y, and Z. It's like, that's not real perfection. Like,
yeah.
It's a very arbitrary form of it.
Right. And also interesting as well, superabundance of his love. Like, that not just like something that fills to like the brim, but something that overflows and like flows out into us. And I think that's a very beautiful image.
Yeah.
In a way, he was compelled to do so. Like, obviously God like could have done it or not.
But it's like he felt so strongly for his creation and for the fate of man that he chose to do this when he could have, you know, a million other ways he could have done it, but he chose, like, this specific path.
Right. No, definitely. Let's finish up. This is the last paragraph. By giving us his Son, whom he did not spare, precisely so that he might spare us, he bestowed on us at once every good, grace, love, and heaven. For all these goods are certainly inferior to the Son. He could not spare his own Son, but handed him over for all of us. How could he fail to give us, along with his Son, all good things?
Did not spare precisely so that he might spare us. Mm-hmm. That's like...
Yeah. That's kind of like... Yeah, just like it shows the extent that God is willing to go for us. And also, like, if the Son is as good as, like, you know, we believe him to be, because he is God, think about how much inferior all these other gifts are. Wouldn't God, if God is willing to bestow upon us this greatest gift of his, like, Son, wouldn't he also bestow upon us these other goods? And it's a very interesting argument.
Yeah, like, if he was willing to sacrifice his own Son for us, like, yeah, it's, how can you then doubt God's, like, ability in your, to help you in your own life, you know? It's like, right, when he's able to do this monumental task, it's like, yeah, everything else is insignificant.
And I think that there's a lot of interesting thoughts here. So, like, so he did not spare his Son so he could spare us, and he bestowed upon us, you know, every good, grace, love, and heaven. I think he makes him at the crucifixion, because it's at the crucifixion, one, that the church was born when his side was pierced.
Right.
Because the idea is, like, you know, Adam, the rib from Adam was created Eve. And now...
like, from the rib, because it's from his Adam's side came Eve, and then from Christ's side
came the church. Yes, who is his bride? You know, like, the crucifixion is like the wellspring of grace that, like, all the sacraments flow from. God, or Christ, you know, redeeming man upon the cross and allowing him to win heaven. All that just from, like, this one act. And really quite interesting, like, I attended a talk a few weeks ago, and they're talking about Mary, but one of the things they mentioned was how Christ, because he is, like, has a hypostatic union, he's fully God, fully man, he could have chosen, because he had such, like, rational, like, influence over his, like, passions and emotions, Christ could have willingly chose not to feel, like, not to have felt any pain on the crucifixion,
like,
but he willingly chose every second of his, like, suffering for us. Like, every second he was saying, he said yes to. Which I think is quite, very beautiful.
I never even thought of that.
Yeah.
But, like, it makes sense, because, like, yeah, he's God. He could have, you know, he could not chose to feel pain, could have disappeared.
Yeah.
If he wanted to, but no.
He could have called upon his angels. And I think that kind of just shows, like, how many of us, like, would be okay with saying yes to, like, just an agonizing death, like, every second for love of somebody else. Like, I don't think any of us could have done something like that.
Yeah.
Anything else?
It's a beautiful reading. I mean,
it is. You know, it is quite good.
I've been meaning to read at some point Liguori's work on Mary.
Yeah.
It's the Glories of Mary, or...
Yeah.
So I'm like, if it's anything like this, it's... You know.
Yeah, it's quite good. I think there's, like, so much denseness. And I think one thing that a lot of us, at least what I unfortunately, a habit I have cultivated, unfortunately, is trying to like rush through the office. Not like in a, like, maybe not, yeah, rush through. Maybe rush is not a bad word, but like, okay, like, here we go. Like, let's just go ahead and say this. Like, okay, blah, 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 you know. And then, like, not really contemplating, like, what do these words mean? What impact does that have on my life?
Well, it's like, for such a short reading, there's so much that's packed into it. Like, yeah, you could, like, read it many times again.
And get something out of it.
Yeah.
And, well, it's kind of like the spiritual reading. You don't really read a spiritual book cover to cover. And, like, you don't really read, like, a spiritual book, like, the way, like, you would read, like, a normal book. Like, you're supposed to, like, read it and, like, let it sit with you and, like, think about it and meditate upon, like, what does this have? What words does this author write that, like, has some impact on my life? And how can I, like, live out what they're saying in my life? Obviously, read the saints. They're very good. They're very good.
Yeah, just, you know, kind of important.
And it's, what's really, I'm not gonna lie, the Office of Readings is my favorite because we get so much, like, varied interpretations and, like, insights that I would never have considered, and, like,
well, such a
other
great
21st century Americans would never consider. But St. Alphonsus Liguori, through his own experiences living in, like, Italy in the 18th century, has more things that he can impart upon us.
Like, there's, despite the circumstances, original, like, eras that these saints were living in, it's like their wisdom is still highly relevant to us now, and it will always be relevant to, you know, future generations of Catholics.
Definitely. I really enjoyed this. I kind of want to do this again.
Yeah.
Like, spiritual readings, like, absolutely, shorter spiritual readings that we talk about.
Because we were flipping through, like, kind of the table of contents as to, like, who the reading. There were a lot of interesting authors.
Yeah, there were.
So it's like there's plenty to choose from for future readings.
But. Oh yeah, there's a lot of really good ones. But that's all I think we have to say.
Yeah. Next week we'll have an interview, and then after that we'll kind of just keep going from there. Probably more readings, and, you know, it'll probably just be a mix of interviews and readings, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, but shorter readings, because we're really busy. We can't, like, knock out, like, a 300-something
read, you know, 200 paragraphs of Fratelli Tutti for an episode. It's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, we're busy people, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But thank you, guys. I hope that was enjoyable. I hope you guys gained something from that. But, yeah.
All right. We will talk to you guys next week.
All right, see
you. Take care.